Friday, May the 19th, and this is the Inside Politics podcast wrap of the week from the Irish Times. I'm Hugh Linehan. With me today in studio are Pat Leahy and Jack Horgan-Jones from our political staff. Hello to you both.
Hello in person, Hugh.
Hugh. How are you?
I'm very good. It's great to see you in person. It's very rare that we get to do these Friday ones entirely in person. We should do it more often. It's been a busy week, but it's been busy mostly on a single subject, Jack, and you've been covering quite a lot of it, which is these ongoing ructions over accommodation for asylum seekers.
Yes, I think we've all had a go writing the front page lead this week on the asylum seeker controversy. And as a correspondent, an eager correspondent in government, pointed out to me today, I can't remember the last time that the Irish Times led on the same story for 5 days in a row. And they also had plenty of words of invective for RTE, who have relentlessly led bulletins all week with the controversy over the location of asylum seekers.
Do they think we're blowing it out of proportion?
It's crowding out all the news about the amazing things the government is doing, I think, might have been the point, was it?
Yeah, reading between the lines and the swear words, yes, I think that might be the suggestion. And look, they may have something of a point, but I think that it also betrays probably the lack of comfort or the concern, I think, within government over the fact that this is a crisis that probably ebbs and flows in terms of its topicality and importance. Once every kind of 4 to 6 weeks, I find that we are writing about it more than we have done for the last 4 to 6 weeks. But it doesn't seem to be something that the government is kind of wrapping its arms around. And that's something that we're going to be looking at in tomorrow's paper and Saturday's paper. We have a long read in on the kind of the politics of migration and how it kind of seems to exercise pressure at all different levels of politics, whether that's, you know, at a local level, as we've seen in Inch and Clare all week long, or at a national level. We saw it spill over into some fairly tense exchanges at Cabinet this week, which ourselves and others reported on in Tuesday or Wednesday's paper. And we're also having a look at, you know, the finances of providing refugee accommodation, something that the Irish Times has been looking at for the last little while. We have the details of a new refugee accommodation centre in a part of the country that some people have argued is a little bit underserved by facilities of this nature.
Where would that be?
It's in South Dublin, one of the nicer parts of South Dublin, but details in tomorrow's Irish Times. And looking at, I suppose, the question of, you know, how do the politics of this all work out? You know, should we expect to see this being an item that kind of galvanizes the debate at election time? Or, you know, is it going to be visible within the national polling? Or is it kind of, you know, forming voter intent or shaping local politics at a more kind of, you know, granular level or a harder to detect level? And is this migration politics something that we need to get used to in Ireland? Is it something that, you know, we've avoided for quite some time and a topic that has overtaken, taken over politics in other European jurisdictions and we've had something of a charmed existence hitherto on?
So we went into quite a lot of this in some detail on Wednesday's podcast, Pat, but listening to Jack there, one of the things that strikes me is he says it comes in waves. And we can certainly see that in terms of the news cycle. But underneath those waves, it seems to me there's an incremental problem that just appears to be getting worse rather than better, with no sign of that changing.
Yeah, well, I mean, the reason that this was such a story all week, I think, was that, you know, some very newsworthy things happened last weekend. You know, there was a major protest in Dublin city centre. There was a bunch of tents were burned out of it by far-right protesters. And, you know, I think we mentioned this on the midweek podcast as well, that, you know, the guards briefed government that there have been 125 anti-immigration protests in Dublin so far this year, you know. So this is the reason that we're writing about it on the front page every day this week is because it's a really important issue and has transfixed the political system this week. As Jack mentioned earlier, and as you reported during the week, it was the subject of a row at Cabinet, and there's the ongoing situation down in Clare. And
can I ask you on the politics of it? We reported the row in Cabinet. How serious is the row in Cabinet?
So
it's not a coalition.
It's not a split between the parties or between different elements in Cabinet. There was, insofar as we can piece together, fairly feisty exchanges where Roderick O'Gorman was looking for more help from some of his cabinet colleagues, some of which, particularly Dara O'Brien, was mentioned in dispatches, came back and said, look, we've we've done everything that you asked us for, and it's time for you to do some things as well.
What sort of things?
Roderick O'Gorman went out very deliberately, I think, on the Wednesday to calm the troubled waters. He did a doorstep down in his department on Baggot Street, which I noticed was attended by the Assistant Government Press Secretary from the Green Party and by one of Eamon Ryan's chief advisors. And the purpose of all that, I think, was to mend some fences. Leo Varadkar had earlier that day said anything that he's asked for, he has been given. And the line coming out of Roderick O'Gorman at that stage was very much, yes, everything that I've asked for, I've been given, but we all need to do more as a government. And he was presenting it very much as a whole of government challenge, whereas the view of some of his colleagues would be, yes, that is true, but only in the sense that government acts as a collective authority. There is delegated authority for dealing with individual issues in your own department, so now kindly get on with it.
This particular subject of where responsibility lies and it lying solely with Roderick O'Gorman and his department has been a subject of conversation for some time, hasn't it? I seem to remember 5 or 6 months ago this came up, that, you know, this was, you know, an unanticipated crisis, certainly at the scale of, you know, with the Ukrainian arrivals and the other stuff. And that, you know, Roderick O'Gorman, first time TD, first time minister, relatively small department, which in its shape is not necessarily built to deal with this as its primary subject, you know, that it needed some kind of a rethink and some other people to pile in, no?
Yeah, that was a big thing around the time of the Taoiseach changeover. It was fairly well flagged that we weren't going to get much of a cabinet shake-up, but there was a suggestion that there might be a kind of formal reorganization of the integration function. And then even though certainly the mood music from the Greens and from Roderick O'Gorman's camp has been, you know, I need more help here. When push came to shove around last December, my memory is that he actually kind of said, you know, more or less, I'm fine. We don't need to certainly create a dedicated senior cabinet ministry for integration. I'm not drowning here. And he ended up getting an extra minister of state in the form of Joe O'Brien, who is responsible for integration functions. So it wasn't quite a seismic or fundamental reorganization. And I suppose you could argue that, you know, if he wanted to hit the eject button on it, then that was his opportunity. And he kind of dug in, and that digging in followed on. And this is a point that the Taoiseach made in an interview with Claire Byrne on Thursday, that followed on from a request from the Green Party during the government formation negotiations to extract the integration functions from the Department of Justice, from, in the words of one source, the cold-hearted Department of Justice, spoke to me for the piece this weekend, and put it into a department that the Greens would hold the portfolio, because they wanted to do things like solve direct provision and so on, and they wanted to kind of have that political feather in their cap come next election, because it's very important to them, very important to their base. That agenda has obviously been blown out of the water by the Ukraine crisis and by the massive upsurge in more traditional asylum seekers coming to these shores, to the point where, you know, I think that the direct provision reorganization agenda is gone effectively. I think people have admitted that.
Well, when you've got 500 people living on the streets who've been told that the state has no capacity to provide them with accommodation, as the courts have told the state that legally it must do, at that point the urgency of reforms to the direct provision system,
the idea that we're going to bring in a new direct provision system which has own door accommodation for everyone, which is one of the kind of signifier things that we'd move away from congregated kind of direct, you know, the big Mosny style stuff and towards something more approaching apartments. That just seems like a fanciful pipe dream. And I mean, to come back to the main point, though, I think that the tensions within cabinet stem from the fact that this is, you know, becoming intractable. The question I have is the degree to which people are actually going to vote in it next time. I don't know whether either of you have a view on that.
It's hard to see the political division on it. I mean, to the extent that there is political division, I suppose what the opposition are saying is that you should be doing what you're doing just more efficiently and more quickly. Whereas there isn't a political constituency, at least within the Dáil, to say, for example, as there is in many other European countries, stop letting so many foreigners into our country. That's just not there.
But isn't their point? One point which you made in Wednesday's podcast is that it could serve to establish a narrative about the government being incompetent or not carrying out its basic functions. And the other point, the bigger point, which other people have pointed out too, is that this could be the moment in advance of that European trend, which you talked about, starting to become evident at an electoral level, for example, at the next local elections.
Well, true, of course, just because I mentioned it on Wednesday doesn't mean that I necessarily hold the same view today. But in this instance...
Our listeners will be familiar with that phenomenon.
I'm sure. In this instance, I do. The only thing about that sort of slight realignment bit that you've been that you mentioned is there is that people have been kind of talking about that for a long time, and it hasn't happened. And while there is clearly a bunch of people who are very agitated by immigration, there isn't, I think, any signs. And I suppose the real test of this would maybe come in the local and European elections of next year. But so far, there isn't really a sign. And we've just discussed this aspect of Irish politics here before. There isn't really a sign that it is gaining an electoral foothold and that people will vote on this above the other things that they believe to be important. And I think that's it may well be, you know, that there is a large number of people who are a bit uneasy about levels of immigration. I don't know, we haven't polled on it. But whether they vote for candidates that stand particularly on that platform is altogether a much bigger question. If you take the example, say, of abortion, a third of the electorate voted against the liberalisation of abortion. But the number of people who think it's the most important issue when selecting a candidate is and has always been tiny.
And that's what history tells us. Do you agree with that, Jack?
I do in the round. I think that, first of all, from a kind of party political point of view, I don't think that there's a future in which the Dáil has a large party for which migration is a main issue, or a large party for which migration is even a large issue. But I do think that it can form part of a kind of political mood music whereby someone who has as part of their platform a kind of classic populist stance that, you know, Dublin or policymaking elites are disinterested in you. They think that you're incidental to their wider plan. They are indifferent to your interests, your outlook, and really, you know, where you live is by and large just a parking place for their policy problems. And, you know, people who perceive that may also perceive that they're being talked down to and by liberal media elites like us, and, you know, described lazily as racists. And, you know, they would feel, I think that could build a bit of a head of steam. I think that where that goes likely is to independence, though, rather than to any political party as such. And that I think that this is something that we've said in this studio many times before, that, you know, an independent who can effectively kind of pull those threads together and make the feeling of being marginalised by migration politics, as opposed to necessarily being anti-migrant or anti-immigration, to the forefront of what they're talking about, I think they might well encounter a good degree of success.
Yeah, but it's, I wonder though if, you know, that kind of weaponization, if you like, of the political weaponization of the immigration thing doesn't take place in and of itself. It's not, there isn't an immigration silo that is likely to, I think, politically radicalise very many people. No doubt it may happen for some people, but there is a receptor for that same sort of being ignored by the elites feeling and section of the electorate, which is anti-establishment and whose sense of being ignored is catered for by a political party. And a lot of those voters go to Sinn Féin. It's just that Sinn Féin has stood against the anti-immigration.
Indeed, and this is why some people think that where you might see a political manifestation of this is after Sinn Féin enters government and perhaps its current coalition starts to fall apart to some extent. We're going to leave that subject there for the moment. It's a very serious subject. We're going to be talking about a slightly more absurd and, to my mind, entertaining subject after the break. Before we do that, just to remind you that you can subscribe to the Irish Times at the unsurprising URL of irishtimes.com/subscribe. If you haven't already done so, I urge you to do it right now. We'll be back after this. And Pat and Jack are still here. What are we going to do about Matt Barrett?
No, nothing, I think. Yes, Matt Barrett was in the news this week. Miriam Lord wrote about this in her Saturday column last week.
He broke the big story.
He had sent various Instagram posts to his followers.
Have we explained that Matt Barrett is the Taoiseach's partner?
Sorry, the Taoiseach's partner. For 7 years, as the Taoiseach told us during the week. Maybe this is some class of 7 year itch, I don't know. Anyway, so he sent various kind of snarky posts poking fun.
They were a little bit funny.
Not terribly funny, I thought. But anyway, I'm perhaps not the best judge of that. But anyway, so he was in a little bit of trouble first. He apologised, and I think everybody agreed to move on. Is that it?
Right. Well, I think sort of the English press had a minor tizzy over it when they picked up our story.
On
Monday morning. I may be over reading too much into this, Jack, but there seems to me the Leo Varadkar brand, let me put it that way, which was very much what Fine Gael bought into when they made him their leader, however many years ago it was now, 6 years or so ago, seems increasingly tarnished to me. What used to look authentic now just looks a bit juvenile. What used to look modern now starts to look a bit glib. Am I wrong?
Well, I mean, we should draw a distinction, of course, between the Taoiseach and his partner. But I can see what you're getting at. I mean, I do think that, you know, Matt Barrett has a right to a private life and a private social media presence. But, like, we should, you know, 350 people in a closed group on Instagram is not that private.
As I was saying to 350 of my closest friends.
Exactly,
Only earlier today. And, of course, he absolutely does have a right to a private life. There's no doubt about that. And I think there's a broad acceptance for that.
There is, among people.
At the same time,
there's a ceiling on that.
He's not at the coronation because he's Dr.
Exactly,
Matt
exactly. That's the point I'm coming to. You know, that like,
just the same as if Sabina Higgins started to throw bread rolls around at the banquet, I think we might be
I'm putting it on her Instagram.
You might be entitled to.
I mean, I've been very rude about the coronation, but that's fine because I wasn't invited. You know, isn't that really the point?
Nor are you likely to be at this stage.
No, I think not. No.
Yeah, well, give it time. You know, there'll be one along in just a few short years, I'm sure.
Well, that was part of the apology, wasn't it? It was never going to happen again. But presumably it wasn't ever going to happen again because he's not going to be back there in Westminster Abbey.
Yeah, but look, I suppose it does. He is there as the partner of the Taoiseach, and it does put a bit of a cloud over it. You know, the fact that he was kind of being cheeky and glib in a way that is at best kind of semi-private, you know, because he knows, he and Leo Varadkar both know that they are very much in the public eye here and that there is an audience out there for, you know, the space between their personal lives and their professional lives, or at least between the Taoiseach's professional life, and that broadcasting something to 350 people, all of whom can screen grab it at a moment's notice and send it on to journalists, as happened.
In a situation where you've been asked not to use your phone.
In a situation where you're supposed to be fairly solemn, you know, even if in your private innermost sanctum you think it's a bit silly, or you think that, you know, I can make a couple of jokes of this.
It's a bit undergraduate, really.
Anyway, I think we've probably exhausted that subject, and maybe it's not as serious as I think it is anyway. A much more serious subject is the political future of Northern Ireland. As we speak, the count is taking place in the local elections there. It's always a hazard if you're on a podcast, because you're not a live breaking news operation, that anything we say will have been overtaken by events within the time it takes to put this podcast up on the internet. But early indications, Pat, are that Sinn Féin is doing well, the SDLP is doing particularly badly, and the kind of the struggle within unionism is more or less around as it was the last time. As I say, those are early indications, but if that's the case, none of them are very surprising. I suppose really, for us at this particular moment in time, the question is, where are political events likely to go in Northern Ireland once the dust settles after this count?
Yeah, look, obviously, very early days, and I heard some suggestion even earlier than the point at which we're recording this, that is to say this morning, that the Alliance were doing well in some boxes that were being opened. We have a very partial picture at this stage, but it does seem that, I suppose, recent trends are continuing, so to speak. And so it'll be interesting to see if Sinn Féin gets it over the line as the largest party in local government. I would have said that's probably likely, but we won't know for sure for some time. I suppose the bigger question then is what does this do to political unionism and to the DUP in particular, as it weighs up this question of whether it's going to go back into the power-sharing institutions or not. The general expectation in London and in Brussels is that it will. There's a little more scepticism about it in Dublin. I think on balance, the view in Dublin is that the DUP will rejoin the power-sharing institutions, but they are less certain of that than people in London appear to be. And I think that scepticism is probably justified.
And is that because of knowledge of what's going on internally within the DUP?
I think it's because of knowledge of the comfort that the DUP has with remaining outside any institutions. The DUP have been outside the power-sharing institutions at various points, including from the very start. And if Geoffrey Donaldson is to go back in, he will want to do so from a position of strength within the broader unionist community. And what we will find out from these elections, in which we're not really in a point at a point to say at the moment, I think maybe we'll be later tonight or certainly tomorrow, is whether he is in a stronger or weaker position within the unionist community.
So does that mean, Jack, that the key numbers here are not the ones between Sinn Féin and the SDLP, although obviously it's very important for Sinn Féin to replicate its achievement in becoming the largest party in local government, as it already has done in the Assembly elections, but it's the relative balance between the DUP and the TUV?
I think that's right, and it strikes me that the DUP can lose at a kind of headline level this election, and in that Sinn Féin could walk away being the largest party of local government in the north. But in probably a more meaningful sense, they could extract a win from it if they can come out of it in the first instance at a higher vote share than the Stormont elections last year, which, if memory serves, I think they were the low at 20-21%. Mm-hmm. If they could, I think they were polling in the mid-20s in the run into this. So if they can show that they went through that really kind of quite painful period around the Stormont elections and came through the way in which they handled the Windsor framework and their strategy thereafter, which is to kind of slow walk it all the way out to this point and actually increase their vote share and retain the kind of primacy at the head of unionism, then I think that, you know, that's more than a qualified success. And I think that is actually a success relative to where they were after the last set of elections, to be honest.
Okay. Every Friday we do pick a few articles from the Irish Times over the course of the week that we found particularly interesting to recommend to our listeners. And actually, the article you picked, Pat, sort of relates to this because it's by the commentator Alex Kane.
Yeah, it is. Yeah, it'll be seen, I think, Wednesday's Irish Times, accompanied by one from Matt O'Toole from the STLP. And the argument that Alex Kane was making is that unionism needs to learn from the success of Sinn Féin. It needs to think long term, build alliances, act more strategically than it has done up until now. And in essence, I think what he was calling for, without, I suppose, explicitly saying so, is, you know, a far-sighted and visionary political leadership of unionism of a type that we have not seen for a long time. And his argument, I suppose, is that is what is needed to safeguard the future of the union between Northern Ireland and Great Britain. And without it, I think that unionism will continue to be.
Has that not always been the argument of what you might call the moderate unionist centre?
Well, yes and no, but the unionism didn't have to win any arguments before, because the inbuilt or the designed feature of the northern state was to supply unionism with a permanent majority. We now know that permanent majority is gone. So unionism needs to change from a perpetually in power monolith to an outfit that is capable of winning an argument for the union. And I'm not sure how, you know, culturally or politically prepared or equipped unionism is to do that. But if it doesn't do that, then it faces a very uncertain future, I think.
Jack, you were reading a piece by Justine McCarthy today, this morning, on Friday, sort of ruminating on all this issue around the news website, The Ditch, which has been in the news, has been making news a lot over the last few weeks. Very interesting interview on RTE last weekend with Paddy Cosgrave, who funds it. And she makes a point, which I think is 100% correct, that there is nothing new about media organisations having a political agenda.
Yeah, and look, this is an issue I've been struggling to make my mind up on for quite a long time. And you know, I think that the emergence of The Ditch and the very good work that they've done on a whole range of stories, ranging from On Board Panala across to a kind of niche they developed investigating the land holdings of politicians, which has in turn led to the resignation of two ministers of state, has asked questions of the mainstream media. And, you know, that's no bad thing. Once in a while, we should all be challenged. But Justine is making the point that that newspaper ownership, I suppose, or media ownership has always kind of in some ways been inherently political, and often newspapers or titles, let's call them, act in a political way.
Whether they've often been nakedly political.
Yeah, exactly. Whether that's kind of party political, and obviously Eamon de Valera's historic involvement in the press there is clear and was acknowledged and is acknowledged, or kind of small p political. Like, you know, I was talking to Paddy Cosgrave actually during the week for an article that I was writing, and he was claiming that the Irish Times and the Guardian have kind of political precepts in their articles of association, and I suppose that's true to a point. I mean, if you look at the kind of mission statements of many newspapers, including this one, they are kind of, you know, liberalism and progressivism and all the rest of it, while never actually aligning.
All that Alshite,
yeah. Never actually aligning to a party political goal. But I think that in the round, what Justine's piece calls us to do, and what I think is worthwhile doing, is to kind of try and build a bit of media literacy amongst everyone, and to kind of read every bit of political coverage, both in the context of what is being said and also who is saying it. And that applies to the Irish Times. It applies to, you know, our friends in the mainstream, in other parts of the mainstream media, including RT. But I think it applies to The Ditch as well. Their stories stand on their own, but people should and will, I think, also read something of the politics of their funder, Paddy Cosgrave, into their output. And I think that's only a natural thing that people do, and that people should do as well as media consumers. And I think that Justine's column kind of pulls all those threads together quite nicely.
The article I picked is the regular weekly Unthinkable column from Joe Humphreys.
Oh, this is very good. Yeah.
On matters philosophical, every Thursday on my own arts page. There's a plug. It's always very good, and it's particularly good this week because it's about a book which I've just read myself, which I would recommend to our listeners because I think it's well worth reading. It's by Brian Fanning, who's an academic in UCD, and it's called Public Morality and the Culture Wars. And it's, we all know about the culture wars, don't we? I think it was Leon Trotsky who said, "You may not be interested in war, but war is interested in you." And the same, I think, is true of many of these kinds of arguments. Joe writes about, there's a central thesis in the book, I think, which is that, I mean, you were just talking about liberalism and progressivism there. He sees a schism happening between those two. None of these words are very adequate to describe political movements, I think. But he sees that liberalism and progressivism used to be seen under the same umbrella, but they're starting to diverge, that there's a form of social progressivism now, which is perhaps more censorious, which is actually illiberal in some kinds of ways.
It's a good deal less tolerant of dissent and the essence of liberalism, just because progressives were on the same side as liberals for a long period of time, doesn't necessarily mean that they share the same core beliefs.
I always struggle with this a little bit. What is the difference between a progressive and a liberal? Progressive is more interested in social equality, and a liberal is more interested in personal freedom. Is that a way to put it?
Yes, I think that's a reasonably good summary for the point at which we're at in the discussion now, but the progressives being interested in the particular design of a society which doesn't necessarily prioritise personal freedom.
Joe writes about, in Brian Fanning's book, that there's a new form of an ideology promoted by an idea called therapeutic morality. And I think we see this in contemporary life, where hurting somebody, or indeed somebody expressing the idea that they have been hurt kind of trumps all other forms of wrong or harm. And that is what underlies,
but hurt in
for
a
example,
emotional or intellectual
that
can, sense.
Well, yes, except that the argument that language is violence kind of extends that into
but it's bullshit, isn't it?
That's the second use of the word of the word for excrement that you've used so far.
Happy
in this
Friday,
podcast,
everyone.
And I'm not going to disagree with your political authority. You are the political editor of the Irish Times.
The philosophy editor, though.
I'm not used to this level of deference, I have to say. But it is the sort of highbrow discussion that I frequently aspire to have.
Aspire is the operative word there. Like, Jack, what do you think?
I'm just impressed by the verbiage arraigned in front of me at this stage on a Friday. You know, being able to summon the energy to talk about this at such length, you know, is impressive. So I doff my cap to you, both of you, and I bow out of the debate.
And we'll bow out of everything. That was our producer you heard laughing in the background there. Not surprisingly, it's a sign that it's time to go. We will leave it there for today. Thanks to Jack and to Pat for coming in. Please do come in again. Let's do it like this from now on. Thanks to our producer Declan Conlon laughing in the background and our engineer JJ Vernon. We will be back with you after the weekend, but do have a great weekend. See you then. Bye. The Irish Times Inside Politics podcast is taken to the road this year with a series of podcasts in front of live audiences. The first is on April the 10th in the Mac in Belfast, when we're going to be discussing the impact of the year of elections on politics across the island of Ireland. We would love to see you there and hear what you have to say too. So to book, go to events.irishtimes.com. That's events.irishtimes.com.